across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
A lot of variety in the show today from, I can't remember what we did, from 50-50 Policing. How can I forget Marcino Muller, who's on the programme today as well. Lots of you saying that you really liked that interview and Marcin talking up West Belfast, the bird flu and Sandy Row, all in the mix of a Nolan Show. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. If I'm not sounding well today, it's because I'm not well. I've got the cold, so I'm looking lots of sympathy. Cold, flu, or one of these respiratory diseases that's going around. I don't know what it is. Goodness sake. Anyway, good morning to you all. Here's another week of Nolan shows. We're on the telly on Wednesday night, 10:40, BBC One. And, of course, we're here Monday to Friday on the Nolan Show. BBC Sounds is where you can listen to us any time of the day or week. Or we're here live at 9 o'clock each morning. The leader of the DUP has been accused of using Trump-like rhetoric by the SDLP. This is after he called on the PSNI to move beyond the craze of work quotas following a suggestion of woke quotas, following a suggestion 50-50 recruitment should be introduced in the force. Gavin Robinson, in his weekly message to party members, and was seen by the PA news agency, said policing should be about ability, not religion. The DUP MLA member of the policing board, Trevor Clark, with us this morning. Morning to you, Trevor.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning. So your leader was talking about hearing from a mother, wasn't he, who was concerned her son wouldn't get a job in the police because he was white and heterosexual. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, it's simple what it's about, Stephen. If you enforce a discriminatory process where your recruitment's down to religion, those things are factors. Indeed, it's affected me in the past myself.
In what way?
Well, I mean, you know that you asked me last week, I think, would I work for that salary? And I said I applied for it when I was much younger. And the 50-50 recruitment was in place at that time, so I was discriminated against.
And what's your party saying then? 50-50 will never return? You'll block it?
Well, 50-50 shouldn't return. I mean, our party's very, very clear in this one here. It should be merit-based and merit-based only. It shouldn't matter about what church you go to, what religion, what colour your skin is. It should be based on the right person for the right job.
So are you telling me that if we had an imbalance in terms of a reflection of society was not reflected in the PSNI, you wouldn't be concerned? You wouldn't look at that and try to fix it, Trevor?
Well, I wouldn't positively discriminate to fix it, Stephen. I think most people don't really care what religion their police officers are. Whenever they make the call for the police, they're wanting a response. They don't ask for the police officer who's a Catholic or the police officer who's a Protestant.
The Lance MLA, Peter McReynolds, is with us as well. Morning, Peter.
Morning, Stephen.
What are your thoughts here?
I really do think this is a bit of a storm in a teacup, to be honest. I mean, I was quite surprised when I saw that Gavin was mentioning about a return to quotas. If he listened to John Boucher when he was speaking during policing board at the start of the month, he was talking about more support for police and we need to get back to business. Stop-start recruitment hasn't helped. Stop-start budget hasn't helped. Those are the consistent approaches we need in place here to create a PSNI that's reflective of all of us here in this community.
Do you think there's a need for 50-50, Peter?
I don't think there's a need for 50-50, and Alliance has always been consistent in saying that.
Why not?
Because there's no magic wand when it comes to creating a society that is reflective of everybody. It's putting the hard work in every single day, engaging with community leaders, engaging with sporting bodies to show support for the police and political leaders as well. That's how we make a PSNI that is fully reflective of everyone.
Trevor, what do you think is going on? Why are too few Catholics applying?
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem, and we touched on it last week, Stephen, whenever you get posters going up in nationalist areas threatening them, I mean, I suppose that pushes it to the back of their mind in relation to joining the police. And I've said before, leadership needs to come from within nationalism to support Catholics to put their name forward.
And so what could your party, what ideas do you have, Trevor, to try to get more Catholics to apply?
Well, I mean, we we're not in the business of coming up with ideas how to get people to apply. We're in the business, obviously, of supporting the best people for the right people for the job based on experience or meeting the qualifications for that, regardless of their religion or background.
Malachy Doherty's with us this morning as well. You're for 50-50. Tell us why, Malachy.
Well, I think Gavin Robinson has slipped up in the sense that he's misframed the problem. The problem is not whether individuals suffer discrimination. Obviously, within a 50-50 system, there is a likelihood of discrimination, especially when the disparity in applications from Catholics is so low. I mean, it's what are we, 1 in 4 of current applications are from the Catholic community. I think unionism, as much as anybody else here, needs to recognise that there is a problem. If you have a police service which is unrepresentative of the community as a whole, broadly, then you have a serious problem. That was recognised by Chris Patton in the Patton Report. It would seem that Trevor and Gavin Robinson and the like are now saying that Patton was wrong, that he misunderstood the problem that he was dealing with. The problem is that if you have a society in which essentially it's half Catholic, but the police force is predominantly Protestant, then that police force is not necessarily sympathetic to the problems of that community.
So you positively discriminate against those people who at that time are the best people for the job. You take the Protestant, or you take whichever it is. If you use Gavin Robinson's wording about people who are white and so on, and you start giving people who are not as good, but you possibly discriminate against them.
No, you never would bring people in who are below par. Where does the assumption come from that the Catholic community can't provide competent police officers? I mean, Catholic Irish people are policing in New York, they're policing in Liverpool, they're policing in Dublin. You know, there's as much of a heritage and a competence in policing skills and policing culture within the Catholic community as there is in any other part. So it's not that you would look at two candidates, one of whom is a Catholic but weaker candidate, and one of them is a Protestant who is a stronger candidate, and up for the Catholic. Patton's proposal was that up to the point where you got 30% Catholic representation in the PSNI, you would discriminate. It is discrimination. There's no question about it. But you would have 50-50 recruitment across those communities up to that 30% point. We've fallen below that 30% point. Now, where are we if we fall further still and we end up with 4 out of 5 police officers on the street interacting with the community being Protestant? That leaves them vulnerable to unreasonable accusations of sectarianism. It leaves them vulnerable to criticism even from within their own community.
Malachy's changed his position in his last few moments. 1 minute he said it wasn't discrimination, and now he's agreeing with you.
I never said it wasn't discrimination.
You can't have a process based on selection, going through a merit-based process, and then take out the Protestant because there's not enough Catholics joined, or vice versa, if even it came to that.
Well, we did it for about 20 years.
After the Patton report, it didn't work. It didn't work.
Hold
on now, one at a time.
Stephen, can I come in here?
Yes, Peter.
Stephen, I think the conversation that we're currently seeing BNI plays on the radio in 2025 in Northern Ireland sums up why quotas do not work. We've turned this into a Protestant Catholic headcount. That's not what I want to see in the PSNI. And Trevor will know this. I took part in a ride-along with police officers a number of months ago. Background never came up. Community never came up during the conversation that we had.
The Chief Constable has brought it up. The Chief Constable, in the interview with Julian, has said too few Catholics have applied. He brought it up.
At this stage, we didn't bring up quotas. And the quotas has been brought up as a solution, or has been brought up as a concept by Gavin Robinson of the DUP. Now, my point is, though, whenever I was with those police officers who were under extreme pressure, community never came up, their background never came up. It was just people looking to serve everyone in our society.
Here's our first call of the day. David North Belfast. Morning, David.
Hello, Stephen.
Morning.
Hello. I think Gavin Robinson was right. And I'll give you an example, just for yourself. say you applied for the BBC.
Yes.
And 60% of the people in the BBC.
This turned me down. I applied.
Sorry.
They turned me down. You've triggered me now. They turned me down.
Don't be ignorant, Stephen. Don't be ignorant.
I'm not being ignorant.
People.
They turned me down for a traffic and travel job. They told me I didn't have a voice for radio. You've triggered me.
Yeah, you haven't got a face for radio air, but don't worry about that.
Thank you.
Right. What I was saying was, say you apply for the BBC or the police service of Northern Ireland or whatever.
Yes.
And they've already got 60% of the people in that corporation that's overweight. Do you think it's fair to, oh, Stephen, no, we have enough people that's overweight. No. You should get the job because you're good enough to do it. And you're good enough to be on BBC or whatever.
Why are you bringing my weight into this?
No, I'm giving an example. They're doing it with religion. They're doing it with colour. It doesn't matter what colour, religion, whatever, whether you're Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, whatever. If you're good enough for the job, you should get it. What is the point of having the job? If I was good enough for it, I'd want it. If my neighbour's a black person or Muslim, he should get it. If he's better qualified for the job than me, and so should you.
I think we should ask ourselves why Catholics don't want these jobs. I mean,
well, it's obvious you know why.
The reason they don't want the jobs is perhaps because they don't fully commit to the state of Northern Ireland. I mean, I would ask Trevor to look at the possibility of a border poll in a few years' time. And one of the key issues that's going to come up under discussion is whether the Catholics are still living in a Protestant state. And he's happy enough to go ahead and create an all-Protestant police service, which would make that argument for Republicans.
That's not what he
said. I did not say that. I did not say that, Stephen.
I
want to respond to that, Stephen.
Go ahead, Trevor.
I have never said I want an all-Protestant police force in Northern Ireland. I want one that's reflective of those who apply for it on a merit-based system.
Well, you still have to address the problem of why the Catholic community is not putting forward applicants.
David,
for
North Belfast, you said you know why. Why do you think Catholics are not applying enough?
Why? Because young Catholics leaving college or whatever are petrified. If they join the police service of Northern Ireland, they're going to get a bomb put onto their car or their family's car or shot dead. Not because of any other reason about United Irons or whatever. That is the reason. And I'll be honest, if I was a Catholic, which I'm not, I would probably be in the same situation.
I think you're right to a degree, but I think there's more to it than that direct threat. I think it is a cultural thing. I mean, look at that incident on the Lower Ormer Road, for instance, when two police officers went over to inquire into a situation and were harangued and jostled. A Catholic joining the police service is going to be thinking to him or herself, am I going to be on the ground interacting with my cousins, my neighbours, and they will hold me in contempt? The Catholic families who have members in the police service already are not telling their neighbours that the police officers in those families are sometimes not going home to the family home. When you see police officers on TV, their faces are screened out. The whole culture is presented as something secretive and something that has to be kept very private, that before you even put the cap on and step out onto the street is a burden and an embarrassment.
It's not embarrassing. It's because if somebody was seen on the TV from a Catholic area on a police uniform, they would be put out, burnt, shot, dead, or whatever, within months. They'd be setting themselves
up. Well, that's an exaggeration in the vast majority of cases, isn't it?
Well, hold on, Stephen. What's happened to police officers in the Catholic community? They've been blew up, they've lost limbs, they've been put out of their homes because they have been seen to be found out to be a police officer. That's not lies. That is the truth.
Jim Wells, former DUP MLA. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, look, we have a situation here where we want our police service, we want all our public services to be representative of society. Or do we? Because callers like David are saying they don't care anymore. They don't care what religion someone is, what skin colour someone is. And is that not a good thing?
It is a good thing, Stephen. But if the police want to make their workforce more representative, there's ways of doing that without discriminating against the non-Catholic community. Because remember, 50-50 is 50% Catholic and 50% others. So therefore, that includes people who are ethnic minorities, Chinese, whatever. So what they could do is they could, for instance, promote the career within sports clubs, within schools, and of course at career fairs. In other words, go out there and proactively promote the concept of joining the PSNI amongst your target community. But what you can't do is to say to someone who's a Protestant who's perfectly able, we would like to have you as a police officer, but because you hang your hat in the wrong place on a Sunday morning, we don't want you. That just simply can't continue.
Malachy?
Well, again, it is simply a question of, it's a question of the need for some degree of social engineering to solve a divided sectarian society. The problem in this community and this society is that we divide automatically. We're divided on housing estates, we're divided in schools, we're divided in sports clubs, we're divided in political
parties. And maybe it's time that changed.
And it has to change. And one of the areas in which it cannot be allowed to happen again is in policing. I mean, because that institution, that just further institutionalises the sectarian division that is a fault line running through the whole of society.
Why does it matter, Malachy, if in any given year there are more Catholics than Protestants or more Protestants than Catholics? Why does it matter? How does it affect what they do on the ground?
It doesn't matter much to me. I worked with the RUC. I know policing culture quite well. It doesn't matter to me if the peeler who's dealing with me on the street is a Protestant. I don't mind that. But it does matter to a lot of people. And if you have a situation where 80%... Well, if you have a situation... No, well, sometimes it shouldn't, you know. But, I mean, the other side of it is there may well be sectarian people within it who will, and the institution itself will have very little excuse for that sectarianism if 80%, 90% of the cops are Protestant. If you're stopped on the street and the force is, or the service is 90% Protestant, then that's 90% chances are that the guy who's dealing with you, the woman who's dealing with you, is a Protestant. And there will be some people who will make a very serious issue of that, and they will say, you're picking on me because I'm a Catholic. You know, that is the way things work within the society. You need a balanced, well-balanced police service representative of the whole system. They're dealing with this in London, where they're trying to bring ethnic minorities and racial minorities into the Metropolitan Police, for instance. It's a well-understood principle that a police service should represent the whole of the community.
Jim Wells.
And we are going back to a time when ours doesn't.
But the reality is that in the last 20 years, it's quite clear that policing has been perceived as being neutral. There has been very little in the way of accusation that either Roman Catholic or Protestant or other police officers have acted improperly as a result of their religious background. Policing's now very much stolen cars, shoplifting, antisocial behaviour. And my experience in South Down, where incidentally the three most senior police officers in South Down at one stage were from the Roman Catholic community, but my experience is that people are not remotely bothered about the background of the police officer. They want the culprits caught. They want
you spent decades in the DUP. Are you telling me the DUP never cared about religion?
No, but the ordinary person, policing has changed.
And brought that into politics?
No, but policing has changed in Northern Ireland.
I'm asking about the DUP.
Yes, Steve, we're talking about policing here, not a political party. And I remember attending a meeting in a staunchly nationalist estate in South Down, which was packed with people screaming at police officers. But what were they screaming? They're demanding more police on the ground, but demanding more action and antisocial behaviour. And those people couldn't care less if the person that came to their door was from a Protestant or a Catholic background.
Dave's in Belfast. Morning, Dave.
Good morning, Stephen. How you doing? I'm listening here less rubbish as usual about equality, Stephen. Listen, let me tell you something, mate. I've never seen a Chinese policeman in my life in Belfast. I've hardly seen a black policeman. I get on the bus now and again, and you'll see a black bus driver. You'll see a Chinese bus driver. So something's wrong here, okay? See the street signs, Stephen? Look at Belfast. Irish language street signs everywhere. Where's Mandarin street signs? Where's Polish street signs? Where's Swahili? Where's all the African nations? They're non-existent, Stephen. Anybody talks about equality, talking out their hat. Okay, simple as that.
Dave, thank you. Peter McReynolds, Jim Wells, Malachy, thank you very much indeed. And our thanks to Trevor Clark this morning, 25 past nine. Stephen has called us. Stephen, you're a taxi driver. Morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
This is about graves.
Yes, it is, Stephen. My mother and father have passed away. My mum passed away in 2020, 13th of April. And my father passed away in 1985 and my uncle in 1982 up in Kilmoney. And we've been going every Sunday without fail, hail, rain or snow, me and my sister. my father, he took a heart attack after he died, and my sister was there with him, and my mum took a heart attack. She was putting her in the bed, and my mum took a heart attack. She passed away.
My goodness, how old was she, Stephen?
Stephen, I can't remember because my head's been pickled. I had no sleep last night, worried about all this.
What's happened?
Right, well, we went yesterday. We've been going to the grave, me and my sister, every Sunday without fail. I say, hail, rain or snow. And yesterday we got the grave, and I said to my sister, there must be a new grave in. She says, why? I says, there's tracks for the digger, and get out. And she was getting flowers, or fresh flowers, put on every single Sunday without fail. Fresh flowers. And what happened was, I looked over and to see a grave, a new grave. There wasn't. There was no headstone. My mother's headstone was completely gone. There was a trench dug where the grave headstone was. Not just my mum's, but 8 or 9 graves.
They've taken the headstone out of your grave without telling you. Your mum and dad's correct. Grave?
Yes, that's right. Yes, same. Yes. Not even a letter or a phone call stating that.
What? Are you still there, Stephen?
Sorry, Stephen, I lost you.
Stephen, I think you've got onto some type of speakerphone.
Sorry, Stephen.
Maybe you can come off it again.
Sorry, Stephen.
That's all right.
Sorry, Mel.
What impact's this had on you?
A lot, Stephen. I actually did no sleep last night because of this. And what happened was, my sister, she actually broke down as well. Not just me and my sister, the whole family. Devastated. Not even a letter, not even a phone call saying they're doing work.
So the whole grave is just, any markings around the grave is gone.
There's a concrete slab, Stephen, left on the top of the grave, a concrete slab. That
They've
was
taken
it.
Away your family's headstone.
Correct, yes. And not just mine, but 8 other graves as well, Stephen.
Why?
Because they're done, the headstone, if I show you the photo of the headstone, where the head of the grave is, we clean it every single Sunday, fresh flowers, and it's immaculate. It is immaculate. You should keep a family grave, right? But the thing was, yesterday, when we got there, it was like a bomb hit it. There was nothing there. The three, everything, the surround, we had a 4-foot surround around the grave. It was taken away as well. And it's actually through the side of the railings with flower plots. Memos of my nieces and nephews has been bought stuff and put on top of the grave. They're all down the side of the trees and the railings.
And have you been in touch with the council? We'll get in touch with them this morning you.
But there's nothing, there's not a thing. One of my brothers is going this morning, or contacting them this morning. But it was devastating, Stephen, when they're saying that. You know what I mean? Not even the knowledge of saying they're going to do work, they need this done, they have to get this done. There was nothing wrong with the grave at all, or any of their surrounds. Nothing.
And sorry, you have tried to be in touch with him or what?
Well, my brother's going this morning. He's going to contact him this morning. So he is.
The question is, where's your headstone?
Well, true. Yeah. But the rest of the surround is all land. I don't know why. I didn't get looking at it to see if it's broke or what. No, the wee surround. It was completely destroyed. Completely.
Surely there must be a mistake here. They're not going to...
Well, Stephen, anybody else? I mean, I'm a part-time undertaker, so and I tell you what, they could contact it, right? Or the name Vaughan, right? And the safe of the name. And so what happened was, they could contact, right? Who done that grave or who done the funeral? They contact the funeral, get in contact with us. Easy way, but they didn't bother. They haven't bothered their backside doing anything. All they done was get the car. Get the car, take it out, or get the car, get the grave taken away.
I'm looking because the Belfast Telegraph are covering this story this morning, so I'm looking
at
the...
Yes, that's right, Stephen, yes,
I'm looking at the pictures. Did you send these in?
I did, Stephen, yes, I did,
right,
yes.
So
yes.
Were your permission to retweet them as well?
Yes, work away,
right,
yes.
So we'll put the pictures out in my Twitter feed now, @StephenNolan, for people
and away the grave, the grave... That was the way the grave was done. The stones, everything, they're all put into a box or into a tub, into a big bucket, and all mixed. They're all mixed. All the stones is all mixed into the stones.
But they've completely anonymised your family grave.
Yes, yeah. Without, they won't offend the family. I didn't know. I had no sleep last night, Stephen. I'm being serious. I had no sleep last night. And I don't know about the rest of the family or my sister, but I am devastated with it, what they've done.
Right, well, leave this
I go every Sunday, here, rain or snow. I don't miss it. Any time I miss it, if I'm going away on holiday, Stephen, but when my niece takes my sister, she's always there.
Stephen, leave this with us, all right? Promise you we'll come back to you. We'll get straight on to this,
right, Stephen, thank you.
This council, Newton Abbey Council, immediately and see what they've got. All right.
No problem, Stephen, thank you.
Stephen, thank you. We'll pause there. Here comes the news. We're straight on to Newton Abbey Council. We'll find out what's happened on that man's grave. Now next, Marcino Muller, the former Sinn Féin Lord Mayor, has condemned posters in West Belfast warning people of the dangers of paramilitary gangs. He says the community there is being stigmatised. Marcino has heavily criticised the Stormont-backed public awareness campaign called Ending the Harm. The aim of the campaign, that's supported by the Department of Justice, is to ensure people are safe from paramilitary gangs and are supported to be more resilient. In the interview, I asked him about the posters and then about a range of other topics. Good morning, Marcin.
Good morning, Stephen. It's good to be with you.
It's good to, and it's good to talk to you. It's been a long time. It's good to see you again. You're looking well.
Thank God.
Is there any
God.
Botox there?
It's just a different drugs regime that you're on. That's all. keeps me fit and healthy.
Okay. Well, look, we're talking about this story of the posters going up. And, you know, I'm reading from one of them here. Paramilitary gangs control our communities with violence, intimidation and drug dealing. And it's interesting that I'm presenting a current affairs radio programme every day. I have no idea how much of a grip paramilitary gangs do or don't have. All up there in the ether.
Okay, so, you know, I can only really speak for the community of Andersontown, where I live, where I brought up my family, where I have a small business. And maybe I can speak for the nationalist West Belfast. But let me tell you that paramilitaries would still exist in that area. They're in factions and fractions and microgroups. They don't control that community. They don't control my community. And the person who abrogated to themselves the right to put up a poster outside my home saying paramilitaries control our communities does not speak to us. And while they still exist, it's also a fact that there are criminal elements right across this island from Cork to Derry. They're in BT9, they're in Hillsborough, they're in Holyrood County Down. And the way to defeat, of course, criminality and paramilitarism is to work with the police to do so. And I'd like to think that the community of West Belfast and our newspaper, the Andy Town News, has editorialised against paramilitaries, has stood up to them, has faced them down on many times to defend the community against
the surge of paramilitaries. Has there been any kickback for doing that?
Well, there has been. I remember 14 years ago there was a petrol bomb put through our Andy Town News window. There was a fake pipe bomb left outside, I think, in 2013. So, but you know something about West Belfast? They wouldn't be controlled by anyone if paramilitaries, the paramilitaries tried to control the sporting clubs or the schools or the community groups or the church groups. They'd be told where to go and are told where to go. So is there paramilitaries in West Belfast? Yes, there are. Are there criminals in West Belfast? Yes, sadly, there are. But they're everywhere. And what I object to, what I really object to, is somebody coming into this ebullient, joyful, giving, generous, resilient, vibrant community of West Belfast and putting a big poster up in white letters and black background like a warning to people saying paramilitaries control our communities. And that's, you know, the only word for that, that's a lie. But worse than that, it's a damaging lie. One of the great things I've enjoyed in recent years is people getting on the glider on Newton Ards Road and ended up in the Andy Town Leisure Centre. But now when they come off the glider in Andy Town and they're our separated Presbyterian brethren, the first poster they see isn't welcome to the community of West Belfast. Here's somewhere you can eat, or here's a university. You could visit St Mary's University. You could visit the James Connolly Visitor Centre. You could go to Colin Glen Forest Park. Instead, the first thing you see at the Andy Town Leisure Centre is a huge poster, again in these ominous letters saying hardworking local businesses are being exploited by paramilitaries.
But Martine, first of all, the Department of Justice say that these posters are across all different areas in Northern Ireland, and we will have seen, presumably your newspaper has printed publications where there are initiatives against domestic violence, there are initiatives against all types of criminality. Why is this not just an advertisement trying to take on paramilitaries? And maybe in a month's time, it'll be trying to take on men beating up women. Wrong with it?
Yeah, I'm going to take it as benign as possible of the people from outside my community who wrote these statements and put them up on walls in my community to brand me and stigmatise me and stigmatise...
Well, government puts ads up. Come on, now.
Let me finish. I'm going to take a benign view of those who have stigmatised my community. But actually, these posters aren't right across Northern Ireland. They aren't in Hollywood, County Down. They're not on the main street in Hillsborough. Why don't they put one at the international airport? The late, great Martin McGuinness used to chide me when I would talk about our communities. He'd say, one community, our community. So if there's a paramilitary problem in our community, why don't they put a big poster at the international airport at Aldergrove when people come off the plane saying, our community is controlled by paramilitaries? Why do they not do that? Because they understand it would be very damaging for their communities, if you want to use that term, or for their parishes. But it's okay. For the working class people, let's bang this stuff up on the walls. Let's serve as a warning to people who want to invest in the area. And, you know, I do a modest amount of work with Americans coming in, asking them, would they partner organisations in West Belfast or would they invest? And I can't think of an American potential investor who, when they see those posters, would say, wow, this is a great area to invest in. Not good enough.
What the Department of Justice have told us is that a number of sites were identified across Northern Ireland where there's been paramilitary and organised crime activity and coercive control. And they say Belfast, Bangor, Carrickfergus, Newton Abbey, Newton Orange, Newry, Coleraine, Lorne, Dungiven, Derry, Londonderry, Strabane, Mosley, Lisburn, Bangor, Carrickfergus, and so it goes on. If I was to read out the locations, Enniskillen, Clawdy, Dungiven, would take me a week.
Funny, I didn't hear Hillsborough. Go back over that list. I didn't hear Hollywood, County Down. Maybe I missed that, did I? Are there no criminals in those areas? Are there no paramilitary element? When I listen to the court cases, and in 40 years of reporting, I haven't seen one case in court of a business in West Belfast being extorted. Not one. And I presume that over all those years, there's been an attempt to tackle what they say is local business in West Belfast being exploited or extorted by paramilitary. So it's not everywhere. It's imposed on working class communities. But I can't speak for all those working class communities, but I can't speak for the people of Andersontown, and I can tell you that what they say and when they say that paramilitaries control my community, that is a brazen lie, and it's a damaging lie as well. And when they say on the Andersontown Road, which I'm proud to have walked all my life, that hardworking businesses there are being extorted, that is also a lie, but it's a damaging lie. And I'm now in a position of denying I'm beating my wife, because I have to go on the radio and say, no, listen, we don't, we're local business people, we don't pay protection money. And think of those poor people running the enterprise parks in West Belfast, Ortis, Workwest, Glenwood, who have done their best to say to businesses, come and take units in our business park. And then the government puts up a big statement beside them saying hard-working local businesses are being extorted. So you're out of spur.
So the paramilitaries that you acknowledge are in that area as well as other areas.
Paramilitaries are everywhere. You're telling
exactly.
Me that, and if you read...
So what are they doing in your area?
Well, they are nefarious.
But what are
evil
they doing?
Presence. Well, you don't have to ask the police what they're doing. I don't know anyone in any of these micro factions of Republicans. I don't know anyone. I don't even know what they call themselves. They're an alphabet soup of organisations. But I'll tell you this, when I do read court cases of people caught with drugs, and certainly these paramilitaries are drug dealing, I see addresses in Titanic Quarter. Why is there not a big poster outside Titanic Centre? And I do see these addresses. It's actually, as you know, because they tell us that the biggest organised crime organisation on the island of Ireland is actually based in Dubai. So these people go in every area. But even if we take it that this was a campaign to tackle paramilitarism, would they not speak to the people of Andersontown first? Or someone who's like Owen Vara Park, such a beautiful street, named after the Owen Vara River. And there's a beautiful mural at the top honouring the great blues guitarist, Rob McCulloch. And if I owned a home and people from Owen Vara Park have contacted me and tried to sell a home in Owen Vara Park, and putting your for sale sign up, then someone comes to look at it and it says at the top of the street, this is an area you should be very careful of. This is an area where you, if you try to do business, you will be exploited and extorted. So I object to that. And I really wish they would take their posters down before the tourist season happens. And there are tens of thousands of tourists come into West Belfast. But before it really kicks off, in God's name, give us a few posters celebrating the diversity I see on the All Saints School in the Glen Road, with Muslim girls going to what was a Christian Brothers boys school with their hijabs on in the morning. St Mary's University College, which is an oasis of education, the only inner city university in all of Ireland, and the great work they're doing. Or the Ulster Orchestra, which has just moved to Townsend Street in West Belfast. My goodness, give us a few posters celebrating the great things going on, and let's make sure that the paramilitaries and the criminals understand that we want nothing to do with them, that we want them to go away, but at the same time, we're going to continue building community and celebrating community.
Finally, final question. Are you going to try to interact with Department of Justice, with government? Is the community going to try to have representatives meeting up with them? And do you hold out any hope, or will the community take these posters down themselves?
I don't think anyone will take the posters down themselves, you know. And I really don't want to get into this world of, you know, so someone insults you at your front door, you're bringing your kids to school, kids are saying, what does the word paramilitary mean? They're bringing us back 40 years when we used to be branded a terrorist community. And it really just distresses me and I despair. So, no, listen, I don't want to get into debating with these people. Maybe I should, but I'm exiting this campaign, as it were. They should just see sense. Leave us alone. Give us a few posters saying the wonderful work that the food banks are doing in West Belfast, the wonderful work the church groups are doing, the community choirs, the small businesses that are working like hell. Give us a few posters doing that. And listen, I don't want to get into debate about them tweaking their campaign or anything else. The sooner they take it out of my community, the better.
I said it was the last question. I lied. Here's the last question. How vibrant is the business community?
Oh, like, fantastic.
What's it like?
Oh, fantastic. So Grimley's Electrical Store, 60 years on the Anderson Town Road. Collins Furniture Store, 60 years in Undertown Road. Ivor's Cafe, I'm not plugging these companies, but he's the guy that just opened his business 3 months ago. They put a poster on the side saying hard working businesses are being extorted. It's a resilient community. It's a very giving small business community. When I think of Mickey Hawkins with his garden centre, 50 years on the road as well. So look, without, they are the spine of West Belfast. The entrepreneurs, the founders and the people in the business parks are the spine of West Belfast. So look, just let us get on with building a great community.
So where have you been and how's life for you? It's kind of like if I'm not on telly, people think I've died.
Well, my only interest in you, Stephen, is how your mother's doing. And you've told me that she's
and not
just,
how I'm doing.
No, I couldn't give twopence halfpenny. I'm only joking. No, you are still, in my view, you're still our preeminent broadcaster.
And that's very kind of you.
And you're doing your best every day.
I accident
the talking head world, and I'm sort of being brought back into it. But I've spent the last 10 years, and I'll spend, if God spares, my next 10 years promoting Belfast, especially transatlantic links. It's no big deal. But, you know, we have a great story to tell. This is the greatest city on earth. And when we go out and tell people...
Is it really, though? Because when people tell me that, I kind of think, well, I love here, but it's not the greatest city on earth. Come on.
You see, maybe you're in the wrong programme. Get out there and see the city. Go out and enjoy the people. You'll never see a people who are grittier, who are more humorous. This is the most exciting city on the island of Ireland. By a long shot. And, you know, we just need to get out there, especially the young people, especially one of the things, great change in my life, the two great changes in my life were the peace process, but the LGBT community, which you know, I say this advisedly, didn't exist or wasn't seen when I first entered politics, and how it has brought such life and vitality and freshness to the city of Belfast. So yeah, this is the greatest city on earth, and I'm going to spend every day I have telling people that. And anybody that says that this isn't, or that my community isn't the greatest community in Belfast, I'll be speaking up against
them. Isn't every city proud of it, and don't advocates for every city say we're the greatest?
Well,
like, what is it? So I live here, I love coming home. When I go away to America, which I adore, I also enjoy coming home. I can't really put my finger on why. I do agree with you that people are, I get it through the radio programme, gritty, humorous. It's why I love doing the radio show.
But what a setting between the mountain and the Lagan Valley. What a blend of Presbyterian and Catholic and nationalist, and now all the new communities, the Filipino community, the Bangladeshi community, the quality of our teachers and You're in America, I'm in America, where the education system's failing. The giving nature, the most generous contributors to the Catholic charity Trocra are the people of Belfast every year. This is an exceptional community, and we are blessed with the community builders and peacemakers and bridge builders who are represented this community way out of proportion to other cities, way out of proportion the number of people who are actually giving back. And listen, I'm not a churchgoer, but I do go to Protestant churches occasionally, and I'm just blown away. Because it's such a wonderful celebration of community. And I never go to a Protestant church, they're not raising money for a good cause. And they're not working out how do you welcome people from other lands when that's a stretch and it's difficult for people. So, listen, we all need to get out more and just realise what a great, great city we have.
It's interesting when you're talking about religion, right? Because I have this theory of a question in my mind, which is, I'm an older man now, I'm in my 50s. I actually wonder if younger people care about religion as much anymore, and even, I'm not trying to pull you into this, British Irish identity, as opposed to where can I travel to, where can I get a good job, how free do I feel? Well, I just don't know that generational difference.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm not a church goer and I don't believe in anything. But I always say, I've been to the Quaker Church, I've been to the Presbyterian Church, I've been to the Methodist Church. But, you know, in churches are some of the most radical places in this city today. There you'll hear people talking about refugees in a way you won't hear in government departments. Maybe you won't even hear in political party offices. When I talk about churches, I talk about people who are trying to go that extra mile for what they call the least of these. And I say that as a person who isn't religious. In terms of British-Irish identity, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have all those identities and still live in the United Ireland? And that is my ambition.
Do you think you're getting closer?
Well, I think if we have a little less arrogance, more humility.
Who's we?
Well, I think people like me from my community, people who have been in politics, people who are still wedded and want to celebrate the city and build community. I think we have to have a little bit more humility, take more people with us. It's beyond peradventure that we're closer now to a different Ireland, what they call previously a United Ireland, what I might call a New Ireland. I think that's beyond peradventure now. How do we get there? A buddy of mine, he gets in trouble when I say his name on radio, so I won't say it. He said, you know, the 10 years, the United Ireland may not be that bad, but the 10 years of getting there could be pretty awful. So let's make sure the 10 years or 20 years or whatever it is of getting there are also a peaceful and positive journey for all our people.
When you talk of arrogance, what do you mean? That people like you have, are you talking about Republicans?
No, I'm not. And I'm not saying I'm arrogant either, but I'm saying if you want to achieve a goal, whether it's a goal in business, it's a negotiation, it's even trying to make a sale, or you want to achieve a goal in your education, bring to it what the Buddhists talk about, the beginner's mind, which is, listen, I don't know everything. And actually, when you talk to an expert says, only one way to do this because I'm the expert. When you're a beginner, you're open to all sorts of ideas. So, you know, I talked to different Presbyterian ministers. I was very pleased when I was in politics, the different Presbyterian ministers voted for me at South Belfast. But, you know, when I talk to people from not from the same tradition as me, I think they're open to a new arrangement in the island of Ireland. But they want me to take my time rather than saying, this is the solution. You will have to follow the path, I say. So that's what I mean by all of us. And I don't think Republicans are more at fault than some. But why don't we all try and embrace each other a little bit more and advance this conversation?
But who, when you were talking about arrogance and humility, were you talking about...
I just talk about myself. As you know, Stephen, I represent no one but Marcin O'Muilleoir. So I'm talking about me, and people want to take this as their guide, well and good. So that's all. And I always haven't been perhaps as inclusive or as listening as much as I should have. So at the age of 65, I'd like to do that more, but I have the same political ambitions I had when I was 21.
So you've changed with age, as all of us do. You say you always haven't been. How have you changed?
I listened to Edwin Poots, who I respect, and he was talking about when he was a young man, he was, you know, at press conferences going to smash Sinn Féin, and what he said was, those were hard times. Maybe it called, maybe it didn't, for hard language. But, you know, we're in changed times, and change is the great constant of life. And it's 32 years since the first ceasefire. So, some of us need to shake our heads, me included, and realise that there's a new generation here. There are new people. There's a whole bright new world out there. So we should try and, I think, adopt a different and positive approach.
Do you believe, Marcin, that our current batch of politicians reflect that new thinking? Because lots of them, with respect, are older and have been of an older generation across different parties.
Well, I think that's wrong, Stephen. All I see when I watch the Assembly debates, I see young people. Young people who are doing their best, young people who want the best for their constituents. Do they fall out to some of the opinions I don't agree with? Yes. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone, certainly anyone in ministry or opposition at Stormont, and that goes right through the gamut, who sets out in the morning saying, how am I going to denigrate another community or do down another community? I think people also have the urge to represent their own community well. So I think we are blessed with a great cohort of politicians. And we need to give them more power and let them at it. Of course, they'll make mistakes, but I think the one thing in common is they all want to build the peace.
What is the potential for this place in terms of transatlantic business, in terms of how attractive it is?
But, you know, the question isn't only in terms of business. The potential of this place is absolutely endless. Absolutely endless.
But you're talking like a port now. So tell me why.
When you think of great Michael Longley and Gerald Dawn, and that's another reason why this is the greatest city on earth. But when you think of the potential of this place, because I think they say that in America 50% of the people are Irish and the other 50% lack ambition, the world will fall in love with us. The world is already in love with Ireland, and we have a peace story in a troubled world. Terrible slaughter going on across the world, and we have a peace story which I think brings hope to people right around the world. And that's before we start saying, listen, we've enormously skilled people, talented people. You should be involved. You should have your business here. But of course, we'd like to do business in your country as well. So look, for me, the potentials, even at my advanced age, the potential of the young people here is absolutely endless.
And do you think, Marcin, that J.D. Vance's ties are here, the Ulster Scott story of J.D. Vance, do you think that is a story to be exploited, given the Trump administration?
Well, I think it's a mistake of people to talk about exploiting either the Irish Catholic or what they call the Great Hunger Irish or the Famine Irish or the Ulster Scots, because that's one of the great mistakes made, which President Trump points out when he's trying to put America first. It's a relationship and a friendship and a partnership, and it has to be a two-way street. So if you want to go to the people of the Appalachians, and I organised an event in Birmingham, Alabama last year, you need to go deal with them as equals and say, look, we have something wonderful we want to introduce you to. We're very proud of what you have achieved. You can be proud of what we achieved, but there can't be this exploitative leverage. And it has been many, many times. It has been exploitative, saying, Irish America, will you come and invest here? But by the way, Irish Americans, we're not going to give you a vote in the presidential election, unlike 18 or 19 or 20 countries in the EU do give a vote to the diaspora. So all those things can be to our advantage. However, it's a very fraught world, and I think there's going to be a lot of other issues before we get down to our familial relationship with our cousins in America.
What do you make of Trump? I know you love America, as do I. What do you make of him as president?
I think he's very dangerous. I think he's, so I published a newspaper in New York when I took it over in 2007. I think 50% of our voters were Republican. There's now 80%. They're not bad people. They are voting for Trump because they believe he will improve their quality of life. But I think Trump's very, very dangerous for the world. Well, I think even his statement about what would happen in Gaza on Saturday, what he wants to do with Gaza, taking over Greenland. I think that, you know, we are at an inflection point, and I hope I'm wrong. I hope that we're not going to end up in more forever wars.
There is an interesting situation with politics on the right, though, that people and reasoned people find some of these people dangerous, and yet they've got to acknowledge and think about why so many people are voting for them. So why is Trump so attractive if he's dangerous?
Well, no, I can explain that. You know, we organise an event in San Francisco every year outside San Francisco and Stanford. San Francisco has basically collapsed in its inner city with drug use, with criminality. Probably the greatest city, certainly the most beautiful city in America. But that doesn't affect the voters just in San Francisco, who threw out the mayor, by the way. went through it, the DEA, and elected a new mayor to try and get the city back on its feet. Because Americans have felt that they have lost out, that they haven't had control of their own lives, they haven't had control of their borders, that they when they were suffering, they thought there was too much attention to other people. If you look at the whole OxyContin fentanyl crisis across America, the Democrats didn't speak about that. So I see people moving towards Republicans, and they vote in their self-interest. So, you know, they're no different from you or I. You know, sometimes people will vote for a politician who will do things for me, and that's where they are. So I wouldn't for a minute denigrate the people who are voting for Republicans and have relations with, friendships with many Republican congressmen. But I think beyond that, I think it's a dangerous time for the world, and I think President Trump has the potential to plunges into a, you know, really difficult decade, in my view. Hopefully I'm wrong.
It shows, though, what a leader can or can't do, doesn't it?
Well,
in politics anywhere. It shows.
Yeah, it shows what the leader of America can do. And on the other hand, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we'll have peace in Ukraine rather than a forever war. It'll come at a terrible price for the people of Ukraine. But would I rather there wasn't war in Ukraine? Yes, I would. I just really despair of the language being used about Gaza.
Would politics here in Northern Ireland benefit from more charisma?
Oh, sure. We have I mean, I'm not going to name them, but we have very charismatic politicians. Some of them
do we, though? You think of Martin McGuinness, you think of the Paisleys, so, you think of how they were massive characters. We don't have that anymore, do we?
So let me mention two. So, but I'm going to avoid the assembly so I don't get in too much trouble. Two people with great charisma, in my view, excellent politicians, great community representatives, John Finucane in North Belfast and Sammy Wilson out in Larne. Both have charisma. In buckets, both doing their best for the community. I don't think they agree on anything at all. So, yeah, I think we have, listen, I don't think our problem is our political leaders. We are too slow to do things. I think that's true. But I always say, when people come to me and complain about politics, I always say, look, listen, there's a lot of blame to share around. The community has to take some of the blame. Business community has to take some of the blame. Politicians take some of the blame.
What about the media?
Well, the media has to take some of the blame, but we're all focused on solutions. So let's all accept that we do our best, but it sometimes doesn't work out well. And I presume the people that put up those damn posters in West Belfast that are sending me mad, I presume they were trying to do their best. Just so happened there's unintended consequence that they're denigrating me and my community. So if we can get together, some things we can leave politics at the door. All the events that I'm involved in organising, we say to people, you check your politics at the door. And there's sometimes we can do that, sometimes we can't. But I think we're on a very, very bright road compared to the past, which an old man like me remembers.
It's been a long time, but it's really good to talk to you again. So thank you
very
much.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Máisín O'Muller. I haven't seen him in years, actually. Describes himself as an old man. I'll tell you what, he wears an earring and pulls it off effortlessly. As he does conversation, it was good to speak to Máisín. The 10 o'clock news is coming up right now. Good morning, everyone. Hope you're all right. It's about time we get rid of this cold weather, isn't it? I'm sick being freezing, for goodness sake. Bring on the spring and the joy of spring. Hello, Gerard.
Hello there, Stephen.
Have you got joy in your heart today, Gerard?
I always do have joy. I'm a happy-go-lucky person.
Good man.
Well, I thought your interview there with Máisín was very positive. Great interview, so it was. And it shone a light on West Belfast, like it's a very positive, vibrant area for a business to go into. And I'll give you an example. There's a kneecap come from West Belfast that won an award.
A massive award. BAFTA, for goodness sake. Doesn't get bigger,
yeah,
does it?
Doesn't get. And they're from West Belfast. So it's not back in the dreary days where it was a dreary area. It's vibrant with youth, young people, businesses. I had a business 20 years ago in West Belfast, and this business of when your business are coming around looking money, protection money, that's all rubbish. That was all rubbish 20 years ago, it's rubbish now.
So the question then, Gerard, is if the paramilitaries don't have a grip on West Belfast, why not?
Because the people just wouldn't let it happen.
Well, that tempts others to ask the question, are you suggesting people in other communities do let it happen?
People don't have a choice. So how come West Belfast has been able to repel these gangsters?
Because over 20 years, West Belfast people are strong and they stood up to the paramilitaries or the whoever these gangsters are. And it just says, no, they're not going to pay. And they've been strong people. And it's about time people stood up and said, no, they're not paying. I understand in some communities that people can't because of their situation and they get burnt out and all this sort of rubbish. But and what I'm telling you, in West Belfast, people are vibrant and they're going forward. They're moving forward. There's a place to invest. America will invest. And what Martin was talking about, in the future, in the next 10 years, this place will just explode because it is... It's part of Europe still. The investment, the money from America, money from Europe.
Well, we're not part of Europe, are we? Northern Ireland's not part of Europe.
What?
Northern Ireland is not part of Europe, is it?
It's.
Oh, you're talking about the EU and the...
EU.
The Irish Sea border that does exist or doesn't exist, depending on what day of week it is.
Financially, we're in a Dubai. So the investment will come to Northern Ireland. If anybody's going to open a business, they can use sterling, they can use euro, or they can use whatever they want. Yeah. Whatever sort of financial trades they can do.
Do you know what I got just the other week, Jared? Just because it fits, no other reason other than it fits in my wallet. I never even knew they existed. A wee Irish, they're smaller than the passports. A wee Irish passport card.
It's like a credit card.
It's the size of a credit card. It fits in my wallet.
Yeah. Well, I travel quite a bit.
So the size of it was more important to me than anything else.
Do you notice if you're going through Dublin Airport, you haven't a big line to queue up, but you have a big line of your UK citizen, where if you have an Irish passport, you can just fly on through. Most people now are going the Irish passport so they can just wheel on through, whereas a British passport have to line up. And it's not a criticism on the ones that have a British passport, but there's more people applying for the Irish passport than enough now.
Hey, good to talk to you, Jared.
Yep. Okay, Stephen. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. Let's look at this bird flu situation, shall we? We're hearing about serious concerns over cases of avian flu in Northern Ireland. The restrictions have come into effect here as 64,000 birds culled at a site near Dungannon yesterday. Glenn Cuddy of the Ulster Farmers Union said lockdown should have been brought in sooner.
The first outbreak of bird flu was on the 18th of January with animals in Dungannon with I think they were wild geese. Then there had been another case in Markerfeld, and you may say it's really mid-Ulster again, and that was last week. And we urged them, along with other people in the industry, to talk about a housing order and that, to bring it in immediately. And that hasn't happened. But listen, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but maybe just a bit slow maybe to get that done. So unfortunately, we are now.
Well, the Agriculture Minister said he and his department have moved swiftly to tackle the outbreak. The DUP's Jonathan Buckley is with us this morning. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Stephen.
I didn't know you were into your birds.
That's a pejorative way to talk about it. But yes, I've been a pigeon racer all my life.
Have you?
My father, yeah, and grandfather.
A pigeon racer?
Absolutely, yeah. It's quite a popular sport in Northern Ireland, believe it or not.
Is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
you know, I think a lot of people don't maybe understand what pigeon racing is, but essentially, you know, there's lofts right across Northern Ireland where people raise birds, train them, send them to race destinations, and they fly home and winner takes all.
Money?
Oh, there can be prize money, for example, in many of these races. It's a bit like any sport in Northern Ireland. There's always financial contributions.
Go on, Buckley. How much have you won?
No, Stephen, that's a state secret.
Come on, is it big money? I might get into this bird thing.
It's quite big in different parts of the world now. There's a lot of pigeon racing now in the United States, in China, for example, in the Middle East. So it's probably small beer here in comparison to some of the pigeon racing circles across the globe. I mean, you know, it's recently on record. I think the record for the sale of a pigeon was somewhere in the region of £1 million.
Wow. Let's get into what you're here to talk about. Bird flu. So where are we at? Put this in some context for us. We're being told this is serious. The birds need to, bird keepers need to keep their birds indoors from today, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, look, it's a very, very serious issue, Stephen, and it's been something that has been on the radar of the wider poultry sector now for some time, because we've heard of outbreaks, whether it was suspected in wild birds, whether in the shores of Loch Ney or indeed other places in Northern Ireland. And the big risk is that if this indeed starts to penetrate through to commercial flocks, that it will have a decimating impact on our poultry and egg sector. I mean, it's worth something like $600 million a year to the Northern Ireland economy. So it's a huge issue of concern. And I think one thing that we have to be careful of now is that obviously 64,000 birds culled on this particular farm. That's worrying. It's distressing for the farmer involved. But that's a speck in the ocean when we look at the commercial flocks that are right across the Mid-Ulster area. And if there is a risk that this disease would spread to other farms, we essentially could see the wiping out overnight of our entire poultry sector. And that,
well, don't be saying that now. No, could, well, we really?
It's certainly something that we have to be very alive to. I think anybody that keeps commercial or hobby flocks, whether it be pigeons or indeed whether they be the poultry in general, when a disease like this penetrates into a particular flock, it's mass devastation. There has to be an all-round cull in order for a department to get on top of that particular strain of the disease. So that is worrying, and that's how quick this can spread. So I welcome the fact now that we have a closed order, and essentially now we have to ensure that we can eradicate the disease spread and ensure that we protect our industry.
So you're keeping your bird. How many birds have you got?
Well, it's mainly my father now that keeps them. I haven't time since I got into this old thing called politics, but somewhere in the region of 200 at its peak we would keep.
Are you keeping them indoors then?
Yeah, there's maybe about 5 or 6 lofts in which they're kept in, normally exercised 2-3 times a day. That's not as prevalent in the winter time.
You exercise a bird?
Yes.
How do you walk a bird?
Well, exercise is in flying, Stephen. So birds have a natural homing instinct, particularly pigeons, where they're trained, brought to a destination, let off, and they race home naturally.
Yeah, but if you can't, I guess my point is, if you can't do that now, if you've been asked to keep them inside, then how detrimental is it to the bird not getting exercised?
Well, it can be. I think it's not really a risk at this time of the year, because closed season normally in the winter means that for most birds it's breeding season as opposed to training season. The training season wouldn't normally start into maybe March time. So I'm hopeful that we can get control of this outbreak very, very quickly and ensure that restrictions can be lifted to ensure that we can have, whether it can be anything from bird sales to poultry gathering and the commercial flocks, we have to protect our industry.
And Jonathan, when you're flying that bird, does it ever go down to the Republic of Ireland or does it stay in the UK?
So, believe it or not, pigeon racing takes place right down throughout Ireland into GB and also from France. So we have races up to 200 miles inland, up to 300 mile from GB, and 500 mile from France these pigeons fly home from. That's a particular example.
Listen, before you go this morning, we had Marcino Muller on there, and he was talking about these paramilitary posters that are up in West Belfast. And he was saying, look, paramilitaries don't have a grip of his community in West Belfast. He doesn't want investors and the local community seeing that up their face. He wants something positive. Just wondering what your take is on it.
Well, I suppose probably we have to look at the origin and reason for the posters. I don't think anybody sets out to put these posters up, particularly government from an advertising perspective, to cause harm. They're probably targeted towards areas in which they believe there is the most risk of paramilitaryism controlling particular communities. So I would say that's why the posters have been put up in the first place. And I think sometimes some of your listeners may feel it a bit rich from Marcino Muller to talk about controlling of paramilitary behaviour, given the background of him and his political party. But that's besides Martin has...
Well, not him. Not Marcino's background. No. His political party, Sinn Féin of the past.
Yes.
Clearly you're talking about. But you're not talking about Marcino Muller.
No, I'm saying in general the commentary. Martin O'Mullier has been a political member of Sinn Féin for many years, long before I ever entered the political scene. And I think some of our listeners will find it a bit rich for him to talk about, people moving towards a society where there was never any control of paramilitaries in different communities. We know that's not the case. Unfortunately, paramilitaryism actually infects many areas across Northern Ireland, including my own constituency where it has happened. So I think for a department to have a proactive campaign to try and target paramilitaryism and try to make people aware of its controlling and evil influence on society is a good way for us to try to transition away.
Nice to talk to you this morning, Jonathan. Thank you very much. That's the DUP MLA, Jonathan Buckley. And just to emphasise, there's never been any connection whatsoever between Martin O'Mullier and paramilitaries. Never. Sandra in Crumlin. Morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Well.
I just phoned in to say that listening to Martin O'Mullier this morning was so interesting and so uplifting, and it gave me hope because I lived in West Belfast all my life. I lived through the Troubles. I'm older than you are. I've seen many, many different things. I've worked in the city centre where the bombs were going off around me. And just listening to Martin this morning, the way he spoke, it wasn't about religion. It wasn't about politics. He has a view for United Ireland. That's a personal thing for him. Doesn't matter what anybody else's views are. But just the hope he gave me, the way he spoke. I wouldn't be in Andersonstown very often, but I have had cause to drive down that road. And from when I lived in it through the Troubles to what it is now is completely different. It looks so affluent. It looks so clean. Living where I am now, my streets, I've been on the council many times for cleaning them up. There's just a positivity about West Belfast and Andersonstown.
I'm going to go up. I haven't been in that road in years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go up onto it this week.
Go up onto it, Stephen, because when I grew up, there weren't very many trees growing there.
Are there many chippies? Is there a good chippy?
There are chippies, yeah. There are chippies, Stephen, yes. But just driving down that road now, there's beautiful trees all the way down from the corner of Stewartstown Road right the way down Andersonstown Road. And it's thriving. I mean, I lived in it as a child into my teens and then got married and moved to two different areas. But it's just so different if I have to go out down that way to go on to the Boucher Road or whatever. It's just so different. And I think there is an air of positivity. And Martin this morning, he displayed that. He showed that.
He's a good talker, isn't he?
He's an excellent speaker. He's a people person. I don't know him very well. I grew up in the area that he grew up in, and he would have lived not a stone's throw away from me. I knew his family, and I went to school with his sister. But I don't ever recall knowing him as growing up personally, you know. But yes, he's a brilliant speaker. And it's the positivity, Stephen. I'm not talking about politics or anything else. It's just the positivity he gave this morning. I mean, I listen to your show every morning, and sometimes I come off quite depressed. But he just lifted me for some reason. He just lifted me.
He's a salesman, and I don't mean that in a critical way, but he can sell, can't he?
Whether it's selling optimism or selling whatever he sells,
I don't know.
We need optimism. In the world that we're living in, with Mr. Trump doing what he's doing and what's going on here as well.
Well, Trump's another salesman, isn't he?
I don't like Trump.
Do you not?
Trump frightens me.
Does he?
He does. He really does. I fear for the world with Mr. Trump in it. I really do.
How long have you been listening to the Nolan Show, Sandra?
Many, many years.
Ah?
Many, many years.
Okay.
I've had your little Christmas cards, different wee things, your little bear.
Do you know what? We didn't give away. I don't know what happened. Got stuck in the BBC machine, our Christmas cards this year. They were very special. We'll hold on to them. The design of them was very special, yes.
We'll use them for next year.
Yes, we'll do that if I'm still here, of course.
If you're not in America, Stephen.
Exactly. Sandra, thank you very much indeed. All the very best.
Thank you very much.
Morning to you. Malachy in Belfast. Morning, Malachy.
How you doing, Stephen?
Morning.
Yeah. Listen, I just listened to Martin speaking there, and he's absolutely 100% right. When it comes to West Belfast and Allytown, I myself run a business in West Belfast, delivery business for 23 years. you know, had lots of local people work for me. The road is absolutely booming, and there is absolutely nobody in certainly Republican circles that are leaning on anybody running a business there. And the man, I've known Martin many years, and he pushes the Allentown Road fantastically well, a road which I was brought up, lived on, and worked on most of my life. But as you know, when I run a business, on like Jonathan Buckley has just said, when I run a business from Belfast and was intimidated out of it by loyalist paramilitaries, my family, myself, and then eventually put out of that business. And then for the last 12 years, I have been hounded through the law courts with the law, the law people here in Belfast, the judges, about going bankrupt because I was lent on, robbed, stuff stolen on me, and then finally beaten with baseball bats by loyalists and put out of a business. And to this day, I'm still fighting to try and stop being evicted from my home. And only this week, because of the poster campaign that went up by, again, the Justice Minister, Naomi Long, telling people to stand up to these guys, I am a walking, living victim of how the state completely abandons you if that happens. And I have written and emailed every politician on that hill, and the only response I ever got was one letter that Claire Hammond's office sent to the HMRC. And as we speak, I am actually getting flyers done to stand outside Stormont this week to give to every single politician that works up there and ask them, what are they doing for me? What are these people doing
for
me?
So you're saying, Malachy, that you're a walking example of, here you have these posters saying, stand up to the paramilitaries, don't let them get a grip on your community. You did stand up to them, and you've been left isolated, and they beat you up, and there's no help for you. Is that what you're saying to me?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And actually, on top of one of my flyers, it says the beleaguered, because that's who I am. I am the beleaguered. These people come up and politicians stand and talk about, we've got to stand up these guys, we've got to do this. But the British government still gives out millions and thousands of pounds to these people. And these are the very people that have destroyed my life. And nobody seems to care about me. Or what happened to me?
Malachy, thank you for telling your story this morning. Good morning to you. And obviously, that's one that we need to ask further questions around. If these posters are going up, what help is there? What support is there for people who do stand up to these wasters, who still have a grip on pockets of our society? 24 minutes past 10, funding scheme worth £200,000 is being planned to support businesses in the Sandy Row area of South Belfast who have been impacted by the closure of Boyne Bridge. Councillor, DUP Councillor Tracy Kelly with us today. Morning, Tracy.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So what's happening?
Well, we've been working quite closely with the DFC, Minister Gordon Lands, and Belfast City Council to try and get a bit of support into Sandy Row. It's been well documented over the last 4 months that the business community down there are struggling and we need to get some kind of financial support to them. So that's what we've been up to the last couple of months, and hopefully we're now starting to finalise the detail of that.
And is this 200 grand confirmed?
It's not confirmed. It's confirmed but not final. So we're still trying to work out the details of how we get it to the business. So that break-in yesterday was not expected because we still haven't got there yet. But hopefully within the next few days we will.
And what's the 200 grand going to pay for?
It's going to go directly, hopefully, to the businesses, Sandy Row, right round to Shaftesbury Square, specifically to try and get them a bit more attractive and try and get footfall back into the area. So capital spend is more what we're looking for. We can't pay overheads or rent or anything like that, but we're hoping to get some improvements into the shops that will be ahead of the public realm scheme that's coming in.
And what's that? The buildings and things and the look of them, the fascia?
Yeah, signage, things that they need for inside, things like that to tidy the place up a wee bit. I don't know if you've been in Sandy Row recently, but it's very run down.
I did. And I noticed that. I thought to myself, This road used to, it used to be vibrant. Here we are, we were talking about Andy Town a minute or two ago. It's like Sandy Row has, it's really, really, I'm trying to think of a polite word and I can't think of one.
Declined. declined is, I mean, we lost our anchor tenants. I mean, Reed Shoe Shop closed there at COVID 2020. Gilpin closed in 2007.
Yeah, I remember Gilpin's. Well, look, Ben Allen owns T.A. Allen Furniture. Morning to you, Ben.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Do you think the road has gone to the dogs?
Almost definitely. It looks like the Bronx. It's terrible what's been like, because Sandy Row was actually one of the busiest shopping areas in Belfast, you know, even as I was growing up as a kid in the 80s and 90s. And then between out-of-town shopping centres, Amazon, online purchasing, that sort of thing, it has just gone. And then the final nail in the coffin is when the DFI went and closed the main arterial route, so people can't even get this anymore.
Like, the thing is, Ben, it's so close to the city centre, that road should be pumping.
Yes.
Absolutely pumping. And with all due respect to Tracy and whoever else, 200 grand's not going to touch the surface of what's needed in that road, is it? Like, what can you do for 200 grand these days?
Well, this is true. It's something, it's a good start. It's the first thing that we've seen now in the area. And obviously, because of the bridge being closed, it's brought a highlight to it. 200,000, it's a start. We need a heck of a lot more than that.
Well, exactly. Graham Harris from Harris Kilts. Morning, Graham.
Morning, Stephen.
Is there hope for that road?
I mean, I believe there is hope for it, but, you know, as Ben was saying, it really has. It's gone to the dogs. If you yourself have driven up it, then you've sort of seen that and the effect that has, even on the local community. I think the 200,000...
Are half the buildings on empty and the shutters down?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many empty, vacant premises along the whole row that... You know, I think it would also put people off coming here because it is so empty. It would be great to see more businesses and things in the area.
And straight question, we were talking about paramilitaries earlier on and the grip they have. If a business tried to open on that road, would they have to be paying a brown envelope every week or what?
No.
Not to my knowledge, no.
You say no, Ben?
No, that's not the factor here. We have a bigger problem than that. We have government departments trying to shut us down.
So, sell the dream of what that road could be.
Well, if we go back to maybe looking at the likes of boutique shops, we're not looking at putting Marks and Spencers and things like that into small boutique cafes, bars, that sort of thing. I think that's sort of the way to go.
And for you, Tracy, what's your vision for that road?
I think we also have to have a look at what's there and what's thriving at the moment. Services are thriving. Dog groomers. The Harris Kilt, the Turkish Barbers, these places are thriving down there. The little tailor next door to Edwin Poot's office, absolutely thriving. But if you watch the programme that was on BBC a few weeks ago about Graham's shop, that was filmed before the bridge closed down. They're talking about how busy they are, and now we can see the difference since the bridge closed. So I would like to see a wee bit more of the history and the culture celebrated down there, a bit more tourism going into the place. There is a tourism cafe is going to be built, which will be Ina's, being knocked down and totally rebuilt by City Council and Urban Villages. So there is things happening there, Stephen, but what I see is the problem is we have a land banking for the last 10 years. Since any talk of the transport hub being built, developers moved in and land banked.
It's interesting. It's really interesting. Tracy, thank you. Thank you, Graham. Thank you, Ben. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. We'll be back tomorrow morning for more Nolan at 9. Have a good day, everyone, and thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Yeah!